Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm glad to be here. Mark your calendars. Next week we start broadcasting on Thursdays from 4 to 5 p.m. We'll continue with the same interview format and authors, editors, agents, and poets talking about everything and anything having to do with writing. We're going to do a few new things, too, so I hope you'll be able to be with us during that time. Tonight my guest is Lori Fox, author of My Sister from the Black Lagoon. Lori Fox is a poet and has worked as a bookseller and writer in residence in L.A. schools. The author of Sexy Hieroglyphics, 3,335 Do-It-Yourself Haiku, she has been an active force in the literary community for years. She's also a literary agent with a Linda Chester agency based in New York. One of her clients, Diane Leslie, who was on my show a few weeks ago, and another client of hers is Wally Lamb, author of I Know This Much Is True, and She's Come Undone. Tonight we're going to talk about Lori's dual role as an agent and author of My Sister from the Black Lagoon, published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you.
Great to have you.
It's great to be here.
Let's first talk about your book, My Sister from the Black Lagoon.
Okay.
The subtitle is A Novel of My Life. Now, why did you write the story as a novel rather than a memoir?
Good question. In fact, since I wear two hats, gratefully, the agent hat would say, write it as a memoir. Of course, memoirs were extremely hot a few years ago and continue to be, and continue to do well. We have quite a hunger to read about other people's lives. But the easy answer is I really wanted to learn how to write a novel. I felt that was something I'd always wanted to do, and I joke about becoming an old and embittered agent if I didn't give myself the opportunity to return to the life of a writer. So that was one of my mandates. But frankly, I felt that I would be more liberated to tell the truth. There's a great quote from Oscar Wilde. He said, a man is least himself when he talks in his own person. Give him a mask and he will tell you the truth. And by the same token, I felt by donning the mask of fiction, I would conversely be free to tell the truth. I like to say the book is 100% emotionally true, while it's perhaps 80% factually true. I resorted to some compression in terms of time and a little invention here and there to tease out particular themes.
Mm-hmm. Well, the tone of the book is somewhat light. There's a lot of humor in it, and as may be obvious from the title, yet you're writing about mental illness. And so I would think your take on life has to be slightly humorous, if not greatly humorous.
Well, I think when people approach me now who are still dealing with struggling with a mentally ill family member, they think sometimes it's a little blasphemous to write about the subject with humor, but I had hoped to approach the subject of mental illness with whimsy and humor. I thought it was important to reveal the latent and even rampant creativity at its core. Frankly, there was nothing funny about it at the time. I mean, growing up, I thought my life was, quote, a living hell. But in retrospect, I needed to go back and find something valuable, something golden, something that worked. And I found there were a lot of surreal images that surfaced, and that my sister was quite a character. In fact, she used to use the argot of gangsters. She adopted gangster slang. As a little girl, she talked like George Rafter, Jimmy Cagney, I should say, and she would throw in some Yiddish into the mix, and so it was this rich blend of gangster slang and Yiddish. Even though my parents didn't speak Yiddish, we don't know where she picked this up, perhaps from my grandparents, and she was quite a contradiction in terms. So I was trying to go back and see what was very charming, you know, now from this perspective as an adult. Mm-hmm. When I was little, I mostly was, you know, devoted to creating a laundry list of all the insults and the horrors of my childhood.
When you were living it, did you ever expect to someday write about it?
I tried my entire life. I especially tried to attack the subject as a poet in miniature, so to speak, mm-hmm. but the subject utterly defied telling. I had always wanted to write a sort of gritty realism and couldn't. My own fiction turned toward magic realism. And in fact, I had begun a novel of magic realism when this story broke through. And I always say, I guess, readiness is everything. I was ripe to tell this story. I'd always tried to and failed. So when I sat down to write a completely different book, an adult fairy tale, the realism of my life broke through. And basically, I just wrote a single vignette and then thought, oh, I'll write another vignette and see what happens. So I was as surprised as anyone is. It was not my goal to sit down and write this book. It just happened.
Now, were you working as an agent when you started this book?
I was. In fact, it took me about 6 years to master, or to figure out, rather, how to write a book, given my over-the-top schedule. Plus, I have everyone else's story in my head at night. I like to say the laptop saved my life. I wrote the entire novel in public, in classic Berkeley fashion. I wrote it at three coffee houses.
Now, which coffee houses?
Oh, really? I should plug them. Well, Ococole and Roma and Milano, mm-hmm. Two of which have electrical jacks.
Uh-huh.
Very important. But frankly, I used to take my laptop without the cord, and I would work on Sunday mornings only. And when the alert sounded, you know, Lori, no battery juice left, I would have to abandon the book for sometimes 2 to 3 weeks at a time. I think I picked up speed in the last few years. I also wrote the book entirely out of order, which some people find amusing. I don't suggest it, but when you have very little time in your schedule, you don't control what comes. You know, I wanted to just I give myself as much license to write whichever part of my life I felt like writing. I did get serious in the last 2 or 3 years and began to order the pieces.
Now, writing it sometimes 3 weeks apart, how did you keep the continuum? How did you keep the momentum going where you didn't just give up because it had been so long since you'd seen the work?
Well, I try not to be too resentful in between, especially because I have this ideal image of the writer as someone who's deeply contemplative, who gets to think about chapter 2 and 3 while they're writing chapter 1. I did not have that kind of time. Because this story followed the lines of my own life, you know, my own narrative arc, I think that's really how I could handle the subject. I did have to go back and fill some holes. In fact, after the book was sold and delivered, my editor said, "Lori, you've cheated us out of your protagonist's first sex scene." And I whined like a 3-year-old, "Oh, do I have to? I don't think I'm very good at that." But that was one of the holes. I really had skipped that. And I was grateful to be asked to do that.
Mm. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm talking with Lori Fox, author of My Sister from the Black Lagoon. Would you read a bit from your book?
Sure. I'd like to read the opening vignette, which I think is the first thing I wrote. I actually wrote a preface, which I won't read, which begins, "I was born into a mentally ill family. My sister was the officially crazy one, but really, we were all nuts." And I told my mother if she could get through those two lines, she could get through the whole book.
And did she?
Yes, although in drips and drabs, she it was very painful for her, not really to live her life with my sister, who is a constant in her life now. My father's passed away, but when she read the book, she was taken with how lonely I was in the book, which was a surprise to me since I'm writing it from a position of a fairly happy person, of a strong marriage and good friends. So, the book ends when I'm 20, though, so I prepared her for that. I told her that my character doesn't tie up everything in a neat bow at the end and says she's figured everything out.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother did read the book a second time, And I said, why are you hurting yourself like that? And she read it with some distance, just as a story, someone else's story, and she gave me her blessings. So I'm going to read the very first vignette. It's quite short. It takes place in 1958. It's called Toast, and it introduces the nuclear family. There's Burton, the television executive father, and in real life, my own father worked as a television accountant at all three networks, when there were only three networks, and was a frustrated writer himself. He wrote some pilots for Rawhide. The mother in the story is named Julia. She's the housewife. The troubled sibling, the older sibling, is Lonnie. And my protagonist, or the stand-in for myself, is Lorna. And we meet them at the breakfast table where there's a crisis, where Lonnie's small act of defiance has triggered a 6.0 disturbance on the Richter scale of the family life. So I will dive in.
Okay.
Julia, my mother, looks like Rita Hayworth, but she's prettier and more real. She's loyal to me and my sister. This morning as I go off to school, she prays that I won't be lonely, won't be nervous, that I will be okay, because there isn't room for another problem in this family. At the breakfast table, there's already a problem. My sister is refusing to eat toast. It hurts her in some way we will never know, but I believe her. Surely Coca-Cola hurts as it slides down the throat, and mushrooms are extremely disagreeable, even monstrous when you stare them in the face. Lonnie's screaming bloody murder at the toast lying buttered and helpless on the Melmac plate. It offends her senses. Mother coaxes Lonnie, just try the toast. She wants to say the damn toast, but she's not going to blame the toast or fly off the handle. It's way too soon. All this noise arouses my father, who enters the room with his big stomach, the little hair he has left flapping in the air. What in Sam Hill is going on here? He booms. Lonnie is frightened of toast this morning. She refuses to eat it, my mother explains. Eat the toast, my father bellows. No, Lonnie howls. No, 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 no. What do you mean, no? What's toast going to do to you? He shakes the slice like a rattlesnake. I've tried everything, Burton. Just let her be. Exasperated, Mother draws her long, freckled hands through her coppery shoulder-length locks. She likes peace the way I like peace. I'll get her to eat the damn toast, my father insists, palm outstretched in Lonnie's direction. Get your hands off me, or I'll strangle you and leave you for dead. My sister is direct. She's taken to talking like a thug to get her way. Too many Cagney films, Daddy says, but I don't get it. Where does this toughness really come from? I don't have an ounce of tomboy in me, and lawns fill to the brim. Dressed in bright plaid Bermuda shorts and a crisp cotton blouse, she almost passes for a girl. But that telescope slung over her shoulder and that buck knife clasped to her belt make people uneasy. They make me uneasy. Please, Lon, I plead, you'll like the toast with peanut butter on it. No, it's got sharp edges. You want to see sharp edges, my father threatens stupidly, the side of his hand cutting the air. Lonnie runs from the table, shrieking and pushing a stuffed animal with three legs and two heads in his face. She has tailored this creature to fit her idea of the universe. The world has two kinds of creatures, freaks and normal people being the scarier and far more dangerous species. They kill the freaks and make them do irrational things, like eat toast. Lonnie and her two-headed friends scramble down the hall, my father close behind with his hairy arms extended. Lonnie makes it to her room and begins to circle frantically, an animal panicking in her cage. Huddled in the hallway, Mother and I listen to some tragedy take place. Everything is a blur when we peek into Lonnie's room. Stop, Burton, my mother implores. Let her be. Daddy, I scream, please. Lonnie doesn't have to eat toast. Not everybody likes it. I am not a little peacemaker. I can't even be heard above the din of arms and legs and howling mouths. I have stopped breathing. Now Mother and Daddy are fighting each other, quarreling over what to do next about Lonnie and the toast. While they confer in the hallway, Lonnie springs onto her mattress, fist clenched. I'll kill ya! I'll kill ya! I'll drag you in the gutter! I swear I'll get ya and drain your blood on the pavement! I mean it! I'll get ya when you're sleeping! Then she laughs maniacally, not like a quote, mentally ill person, but like a cartoon villain. She drools and spits to scare us, and it works. We know she's the consummate actress and loves to play everything to the hilt, but we also know this blonde little girl with a Buster Brown haircut and a murderer's imagination is to be taken seriously. Later, when I come home from elementary school, I see that the cold, butter-stiff toast is still on the table. I lift it up to my lips. I'm hungry, but will eating toast change that? I decide at the last second that the toast is ruined. Lonnie lumbers into the kitchen like George Raft. Uzi! Uz! Uzi is her special name for me. She calls me Uzi because when we play cats, she makes a deep ooze sound through her nose instead of the traditional prrr. Somehow she associates this sweet, contented sound with me, her baby sister. But I don't feel very sweet today, just beat. What? I snap. You gotta spend time with your good-for-nothing sister. To stave off my guilt, we drink chocolate milk from the carton and eat Cocoa Puffs from the box. To stave off my loneliness, we play with dolls and stuffed animals and wrestle like all siblings do. Except that Lonnie crunches me with so much love, I wonder if I'll live through the afternoon.
Thank you. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and you just heard Lori Fox read from her novel, My Sister from the Black Lagoon, A Novel of My Life. You know, that section, it seems that you must have just crafted it to no end. It has strokes of humor at just the right time, and yet it's very sad. How did you work on this, or did you work hard on to make this work?
Well, I hate to use the word channel, but I think that's the best word. I was very submerged, like a submarine. When I surfaced, I often didn't know, I wouldn't know what had happened to me. I was conscious in terms of editing the material, but the first draft of each chapter, I think, I went to a very deep place. I did not...
You were sitting in a coffee house.
Yes. The laptop light comes on, I am utterly focused, and nothing can take my attention away unless somebody asks me about the computer. I just found that worked for me, and my office is not only littered with papers and other stories, but the phone is ringing, and I needed to find a place that, was completely mine, and... So, yes, I'm a regular in a few places. And after I finished the book, I went proselytizing, telling everybody if I could do it, they could do it, because I have no time. The truth is, now that I'm working on a new book, I had to relearn this all over again. There's a certain ruthlessness that comes when you set aside a few hours. But to answer your question, a lot of people think that I relived a lot of these emotions, which is true. It was a form of exorcism, but I did not write from a place of anger or resentment. It was a very neutral, calm place. So I liken the process to someone who's painting a painting a la Jackson Pollock, you know, very methodically, very quietly, not always in some sort of, you know, chaotic fit. I was very quiet. I only had one stumbling block. I was able to write about the darkest, you know, deepest secrets of my family and suicide attempts of my sister without pause, but I stumbled when I began to write about being abandoned by my first boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
I just could not figure out what happened. I thought this was resolved, and I stopped for 3 months.
That's interesting. Well, you know, you said earlier you didn't really plan to write the book. It just sort of happened that way. And I'm curious what you did to make that possible. I mean, would you just write, just to write, and this story started coming out, or how did that happen?
I basically chose vignettes, things that, scenes that were very common. For instance, my sister routinely ran off to the hills whenever we had a babysitter come over on Saturday night. My parents would go out to dinner and a movie. And the moment they were out the door, my sister would act up, and she liked to join what she called the wild things in the hills. She felt she was one of them. She really felt quite an affinity, and still does, for the animal world, because animals don't persecute her.
Mm.
So she would run off to the foothills of Burbank and in the night, and my babysitter and I would have to run up into the hills, often going into other people's backyards to retrieve her. And it was very suspenseful, very touch and go, and bring her back before my parents returned. Often she would have a lizard in her pocket. And so when I sat down to write that scene, it was really not choosing the one instance in which she ran off to the hills. It was, again, it was something that she routinely did. So I sort of combined that with an instance of watching the Miss Universe pageant, which I also did every year. And every year I conceived my own over-the-top acceptance speech, like many young girls do. And I wanted, so each chapter, I think, you know, I had an image of, again, something that my sister did that I thought was quite colorful, you know, something profound. And also, Lorna, my protagonist's flight of fancy, you know, a departure, how she survived her life by resorting to her fantasy world. And in that chapter, she wins the Miss Universe pageant. So we have both the tragedy of the sister running off, and then we have Lorna's fantasy life juxtaposed.
Now, how did the two of you get along now?
Oh, quite well. My sister is quite a conversationalist. A lot of people like to know whether or not she's read this book. And there is an interesting story. During the first year, when I sat down to write the book, I asked her a lot of questions about our youth. She has total recall, and especially because so many of the words we used were fantastic and made up, I know she would remember them better than I, what she named her stuffed animals, for instance. And so when I was probing her for memories, I was trying to make her feel good, and I told her she was the repository of our childhood memories, and she likes to pun, so she said she was the suppository of our childhood memories. But then she caught wind that I might be writing a book, and she put a curse on this book at first. She did not give me her blessing. She felt she would come off as a cross between Jack the Ripper and Charles Manson. And I said, oh, no. I pleaded with her. In fact, I felt the book would be an homage to her and that my character would pale in comparison. And I also appealed to the writer in her. When she was around 10, she began to rewrite classic novels. Mm. Chapter by chapter, she rewrote Kidnapped and The Pearl and Treasure Island. But she added the tagline, a go-go, so we had Treasure Island, a go-go. So, in fact, I appealed to the writer and her, and I said, you know that that I have every right to use my life as fodder and to take poetic license. I assured her that her identity would not be divulged. And she wasn't so sure about that. But about a year later, she called me and said, you still writing that book? I paused and gulped, and I said yes, and she said, well, all right, as long as you refer to me as Mad Dog. So I hastily worked that into the manuscript. Mm-hmm. When the book came out, I felt it was only right to let her know, and I had to screw up the courage even to say it was out. Not that it was out in the stores, simply that it was out. She showed no interest in reading it or looking at it. She very much liked the idea that the four family members have different names because she said that was a parallel universe, and she's a fan of parallel universes. Mm. She also did not relate to the picture of the girl on the cover. She has taken the persona of a man for most of her life, and she's in a transgender program now at a major university.
Hmm, interesting.
So she said, oh, there's a little girl on the cover. That's not me.
Interesting.
So she feels extremely safe, very protected.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a break. Take a breath. And please stay tuned. I'll be back with Lori Fox, author of My Sister from the Black Lagoon. Don't go away. Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, your host, and I'm here with Lori Fox, author of My Sister from the Black Lagoon. You're also an agent.
Yes.
And this is a very interesting combination in a way. Most agents, if they ever wrote, they stop writing when they become agents.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do both?
As I said before, it was tricky, but I was very determined to get back to my creative life because I felt that it would make me a kinder, gentler agent. I would be far more compassionate towards my clients, and I think that's true. I don't think anyone wants to meet up with an agent with a chip on her shoulder or an editor with a chip. There are a great many editors who also want to write and do write and wear two hats as well. So it was just a matter of time figuring it out, and my clients are extremely fertile, so I spent 10 years just keeping up with them, peddling as fast as I can. And I think I had an earlier book out by Chronicle, published by Chronicle, called Sexy Hieroglyphics,
mm-hmm.
Which was just sort of a fluke. It was an artist book I had written. I used to create little books for friends every holiday season. And I happened to send it to Chronicle to an editor who had shepherded the Griffith and Sabine books.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent my little handmade book in with a formal submission of my clients, and the editor at Chronicle called me actually 10 minutes after my husband proposed and said, we want to do your book, Sexy Hieroglyphics. And I tried to talk her out of it, which is not an agent-like thing to do. I said, oh, it's too weird, and she said, we like weird. So I began to seriously rewrite that book. It's out of print now, it's heyday for poetry, and it was a lark. And so I think that helped me ease back into writing. Again, it was just, I knew it would happen. I just didn't know when. But, you know, I also feel that I've learned a great deal from my clients. I'm very hands-on, I'm especially with fiction. I dig in deep and do a lot of hands-on editing. So I think editing other people's work, improved my writing, I hope, over the years.
I guess that was actually a question in terms of how much you get involved with your clients' books.
Well, I was naive. Not naive. I thought all agents were very hands-on. I didn't realize that many agents do farm out the editing, although more and more editors are depending on agents to shape manuscripts and shape proposals. The first agency that I worked at, the Sandra Dykstra Agency, was really sort of a golden opportunity to watch, you know, a master at work. So I was on the sidelines watching Sandra, and within the first few months that I landed at that agency, Sandra was working with Amy Tan on the Joy Luck Club. And so I saw what an agent can do and how an agent shapes the book. And so I thought that's what all agents did, perform heart surgery. So I get in deep. I don't get in deep on every book. There's certain subjects that I am hands-off that I know. For instance, thrillers, it's not my strong suit, that I will bring in an expert. Or a book that I really can't jump in and understand the cadence, the music of, then I might ask somebody else to do the editing. But it's a joy. I actually love that part. I'm much more development-minded than entrepreneurial, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. So how do people find you? You're the West Coast satellite of a New York agency.
Yes, I guess I have the best of both worlds. I like to say that I see a tree now and then out my window. Like most California agents, I work from a home office. My plate is full at present. I don't want to disappoint your listeners, but our East Coast agency is quite open to submissions. It's the Linda Chester Literary Agency, and they're going great guns in the East. Linda and I started in La Jolla. We started in California together as partners, and we both fell in love with two different men, thank God. She moved east, and I set up shop in Berkeley.
So before your plate was full, would she send you things that came into the agency that she thought you would like, or did you say, I really want to specialize in literary novels, for instance?
Well, together we both naively thought we would be an all literary fiction agency. That's very, very tough. It's very tough to make a living with just fiction. 75% of the books sold in the bookstores are nonfiction, which is surprising. So we're quite eclectic. At first, I worked on all manner of books. Now that I've set up shop in Berkeley about 6 years ago, I basically work on subjects that appeal to me. Interestingly enough, besides literary fiction, I have a thing for maverick scientists, and I think that's the path I did not take in life, mm-hmm. And a great deal of creativity is going on in that world that impresses me. I'm also very interested in popular culture, so I'm highbrow and lowbrow simultaneously. I also am interested in serious works of spirituality. That's due to my husband, Patrick Miller's influence, I have to say. Mm-hmm. He writes in that field. Mm-hmm. I'm interested right now in the stores is a wonderful biography on the photographer Tina Madotti called Shadows, Fire, Snow.
That was one of yours.
Very proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's from soup to nuts. You know, sure. You can be working on a book on AIDS research and then on maps and then on Star Trek, you name it. So it's quite eclectic. I like that. And I think it keeps me, I'm less egomaniacal. I think it would be very weird for me to have a life where I just stared at the page all day. I don't think I could handle it, and personally, I think I would become too melancholy. I was quite a tragedian and quite a tragic romantic figure in my 20s, so I think I'm worried about reverting. I'm in my 40s now, but I think if I had all the time in the world, that I might succumb to melancholy again. Mm-hmm. So I this work does keep me up.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Lori Fox, author of My Sister from the Black Lagoon. This past weekend, I moderated panels at the Laguna Beach Book Fair, and one of your clients, Diane Leslie, who was on my show a few weeks ago, said she told a very funny story about how she had really bad luck with agents until she found you.
Uh-huh.
And that you were a very atypical agent. What do you think she was talking about?
Well, she's a dear. I'm not sure. I think that people still have that image of agents as sharks. I know on Frasier there's a radio agent, Beebe, who's quite larcenous and manipulative. And I'm always shocked by that image. When you go to a panel of, let's say, 10 agents, you'll see that there's every stripe of agent on a panel with every kind of personality. So I was quite relieved to find out that a person who is perhaps soft-spoken, as I am, could be an agent, that you didn't have to be a super type A personality. That was a relief because I felt you can only be yourself. I think she meant atypical in that, well, our entire agency, I know this sounds like a tremendous plug for our agency, but we're all very hands-on, and I think we give a lot of attention to our clients, but I know so many wonderful agents in the Bay Area who are my comrades here who do the same. I think we're all quite busy people, and so we do get a reputation for having not very much time on the phone. But once we take somebody in to our stable, I think most of my friends who are agents are very devoted. Probably Diane meant that I was very involved in the editing process and the conceptualizing her book came to me. It was, you know, a gift, and I'm delighted. She's one of the, well, we were both writing girls' rites of passage novels almost simultaneously, so we had a lot to share. So we had kind of a sister-like relationship. I always say, you know, your agent is your advocate and your confidant, your literary lawyer, your clairvoyant, your therapist. But if you're lucky, your friend. And Diane and I have become very good friends. Hmm.
What is one thing you would like to say right now about agents? What do people need to know that they have all wrong?
Well, I would rather address the subject, if I could, about writers who try to, I guess you could say, second-guess the market or what the next big trend is.
Yes.
As an agent, I would rather, if I have one thing to say, is to give a message that speaks to that says that, you know, trends are a moving target. If I had followed the trend, I would have written my book as a memoir. Passion is everything. So, you know, I say stick to your own vision. And if the world doesn't take to your subject, you know, you can understand that. But you're going to be living with your subject day in and day out for years. So rather than trying to figure out what should I write, how do people, what do people want to hear, you know, rely on your instincts. Of course, if you want to write about, you know, the history of screws and find out people aren't interested in screws, then, you know, you have to have sort of a modicum of understanding that you might have chosen something a bit bizarre. But, of course, there was a great book about the history, the cultural history of the pencil, for instance. So I guess I'd also say when choosing an agent, you know, pay attention to chemistry. It's quite a long-term relationship, sometimes a marriage of sorts. Does your agent reflect your values or clash with them? If you write a deeply spiritual novel, you may not want an overly cynical agent to handle it.
Well, should you meet your potential agent in person?
Well, I think a lot of us dole out information about who to choose. But the truth is, most of us don't have much choice. It's so tough to get an agent when you find someone who falls head over heels in love with your work. They might be the only one out of 20 or 30 or 50 people. So it's easy for me to sit back and say, choose somebody that you like. But let's say you meet that person and, you know, you don't care for them personally, but they love your work. You may not have another choice. So as far as meeting with them, if it's possible, I think you can do a lot over the phone, though. I've often not met clients until after their books were out. People often wonder if, because I'm on the West Coast, if I only represent West Coast writers, and that's not the case. About half of my list is on the East Coast, and vice versa. I always use the skin test when material comes to me. I have to get a tingle or a chill and to know it's right. Mm-hmm. And my pupils have to be dilated. And the reason why is when an agent is pitching your work to an editor over the phone, an editor will ask, do you love it? And put you on the spot. And if you hem and haw or sound vague, they can pick up your lack of passion. So, you know, that's why we choose very selectively. I often pass on books that I think are wonderful books, but that I know I'm not the one.
Well, my next question actually was are there questions writers should ask potential agents? I mean, questions that are extremely meaningful, the answers to which are extremely meaningful, and perhaps one of them would be, do you love my work?
Well, I think it's important for, yes, writers can put agents on the spot.
Do you love it? Do you like it? Are we going steady? Are we going to get married?
You know? One of the questions I ask up front is, are you flexible? Are you willing to revise? I take clients, even when the work is almost camera ready, through several revisions. With fiction, almost, I would say, the rule of thumb is two radical revisions and a third cosmetic revision. Mm. So if someone's going to work with me, they're going to work hard. I would tell them that I will not alter their vision. I don't want to impose my vision. Our visions have to match. So that's the question you have to ask. Do the visions match? If they do, then I think the writer should be willing to work hard with the agent. You should ask an agent what are your ideas for changes up front and not find out later.
What if they say, I think it's fine?
Well,
because there are a lot of agents that don't work editorially.
Well, the big surprise is after they take you on, they may say, okay, now we're going to bring in an expert, or now we're going to bring in a professional freelance writer to make this more spiffy, get this up to speed. And it's shocking, but a very high percentage of nonfiction books are written now by freelance writers who are brought in. I am looking for real writers. All agents say that. But also, certain experts I work with are wonderful writers, and to their credit, could sit down and write their whole book, but sometimes they just don't have the time and they need a little bit of help. I happen to work with there's a Los Angeles writer of whom I'm very proud, Jonathan Kirsch, who's mm-hmm. an LA Times book reviewer.
Yes.
He has his own radio show. He's an entertainment and copyright lawyer and a Bible scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And he is also a brilliant writer. He wrote the first full-bodied contemporary biography of Moses recently. And he's one of the few writers I know who can be on tour with his current book and be in the hotel room writing the next book.
Mm.
That's a rare talent. So, to answer your question, I think up front you should find out, if you're a writer, what kinds of changes and how much and how many revisions. That's important, because it shouldn't come as a surprise down the road. I actually sold a novel once at auction and then found out from the editor that she thought the whole second half of the novel needed to be tossed. What a shock to myself and to the author. We should have found that out up front.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's refreshing for writers to have agents who do want to put editorial energy into their book. You know, I think it would be refreshing.
And again, I'm not the expert on all these subjects, of course. I'm really the student. So my clients are teaching me. I basically, all agents do shape nonfiction books. They may not edit fiction, but they do shape nonfiction in terms of looking at the logic of the chapters and also how to position a book, or how to position, sounds so official, but what your client knows. So you may talk to a client about their next idea, and there's different approaches. So you use the word package, which always sounds blasphemous now, but marketing is everything. In fact, the marketeers in New York have more clout than the editors now, so the marketing people inside the major publishing houses have a vote that counts more than the editors. So if you are a nonfiction author, you do have to think about outreach. How national is my outreach? All the kinds of things that publishers used to help writers with in terms of sending them on the road and building
mm-hmm.
them. As a national speaker, now they like that in the can when you approach them.
Yes.
So it's a different world now.
Is there an average time in which an agent should sell a book?
Well, I always say a third of the books sell immediately, on the first round. A third of them take a couple months, perhaps, or a few rounds, and a third. Well, I don't know if it's a third. Maybe it's just maybe a fourth. Take a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
In real estate, the maxim is location, location, location. In publishing, it's patience, 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 and it's a protracted process. If I sold your book, Barbara, tomorrow, you would not receive your contract or check for 2 to 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the waiting game. Well, do you send manuscripts out simultaneously? Will you send the same manuscript to, say, 10 editors at once? Or?
I do. Life is too short. And also, when you're approaching an agent, I always say life is too short to go one at a time. I always encourage authors to cheat in a way, when they're sending a query letter, to also send one or two pages from the beginning, because just as an agent may be thinking of passing on a project, they might just read page one and be hooked. That has happened to me. Just while I was writing the letter of regret, I sat down to read the first page, and I realized, oh, I must have just been in a bad mood or, headachy. Of course, that terrifies authors to hear that agents have moods. But then read it again and say, eureka, I found it. So I always say, even though you're just supposed to send a query and a brief query, which I do advise, why not send the first page?
Yes. Well, it only makes sense. But you read the books, the writer's markets and the all of those resource books, and do not send anything we do not ask for.
I think, if anything, coming into this business as a writer, I've always felt like I was a writer in agent's clothing. And so my sympathies are with the writer, and life is too short to wait. And so a lot of agents do say they must have an exclusive and no one else can look at a manuscript. I would say if you send out to 10 agents and one agent is extremely hot to trot, as a courtesy to call the other agents and ask them if they could look at your work, review your work as soon as possible. But giving an exclusive, that's really up to each agent. I don't usually ask for that. I don't think it's fair.
We're at the end of our time. What else? Is there anything that you think is important for people to know, either about agents or about you and your book?
Oh, dear. Well, my book is out in paperback now, which makes me very happy because it's eminently affordable.
Are you touring?
I'm reading locally. I just got back from San Diego. I think I'm doing some book clubs. If someone invites me, I'll be there. I've been speaking to chapters of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. I call them my people because they not only relate to my book more intimately, but they find it even funnier. I always thought I'd be preaching to the converted. They already are dealing living in families with a mentally ill sibling or parent, but the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill is an incredible organization, both a political for political activism and also for educational purposes. And they have sibling groups, something that I was not privy to in the 50s.
Mm.
And thank you for listening.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. You're just wonderful, and I hope this book just continues to do well.
Thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Lori Fox, author of My Sister from the Black Lagoon, A Novel of My Life. She's quite a wonderful writer, as well as being a wonderful agent, and she's the kind of agent that we all wish there were more of. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. If you have any comments about my show, Writers on Writing, please email me at bdemarcob@aol.com or write to me in care of the station, P.O. Box 4362, Irvine, California 92616. The show is internet accessible at KUCI.org, as are all shows here at KUCI. And as I said at the start of my show, next week I won't be here on Wednesdays, but Thursdays from 4 to 5. I hope you can tune in. Maybe save that time to get out in the car and do your errands, or to be near a radio. My guest will be poet Lee Mallory. Take care and thank you for listening. And as I tell my son Travis and anyone else who will listen, it's all about writing, like there is no tomorrow.